Welcome to Hot Plate, a post-foodie podcast. I'm your host, Mirella Amato. Today on Hot Plate, coming to you from the isolation of our homes. Moose meat, dog meat, taking care of each other, and playing with food. Hi, Joshna. How are you doing?
I'm pretty good, Mirella. How are you?
I'm well.
Yeah.
I'm well.
It's a low-key weekend of feeling good, and I'm excited to talk to you today, actually. We got a bunch of interesting things to chat about. The world of food and drink does not disappoint. And so the first thing we're going to lead in with is a piece that I saw about a high school teacher in Alaska who decided to take a moose that he killed into school and have his students break the beast down. Right, he took a whole bunch of knives, went in and walked them through how to break down that beast, right? And the photos that you see are students at a desk or at tables with their knives really focused
big
on
knives.
Butchering. Big knives focused on butchering this moose. And I think the whole thing, I think it's delightful. I'm impressed completely. I think it's a lovely idea. I was very curious to see what, you know, how the students really felt. There wasn't much information about how the students, you know, what they felt about that experience, but mm-hmm. I was into it. And I'd love to see more of this kind of thing for sure.
I mean, I don't know how much you know about what's involved with, taking apart a moose, but
it's a mega giant event.
I happen to have watched an entire video.
Yes.
From like the very start, which is I think the trickiest bit. And so I was just thinking, how do they even do that? But it turns out that he took in, I think it was just the four legs. And
okay,
they butchered
the
that down. But
okay.
It still took it was still 200 pounds of meat.
Right.
And it still took them the better part of a day. Right. I mean, it was an entire class, but they're not experienced. Right. So.
Right. Of course. Those are not. Yeah. Those are not skilled moves with the knife.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think it's so cool. I mean, first of all, this whole notion of this school that's all about hands-on practical discovery.
Yes.
I want to know what else they're doing.
Me too. Right. Because they have this hilariously generic, though perhaps appropriate, title of the World of Discovery Seminar is what they've called it, right?
Yes.
These off the books kind of things, which is, I mean, it's hilariously vague, but like you, I'm like, what else are you guys learning? Because I think this is fantastic. I mean, listen, I generally feel like if you want to eat meat, you have to come face to face with the reality of what you're doing. And if it means your hands are going to kill something, then your hands are going to kill, you know, then that really is what we're talking about here. To at least face the reality of your use of your power and position on the food chain like this, right?
I agree with you. Yeah, 100%. And that was, to me, a very interesting piece that was missing.
Yes.
In the article and just in the way that the teacher was speaking. And that might just be the nature of the curriculum, but so the people in this class were in biology and in
right.
Alaska studies. So he was able to justify this because he had to get a special permit, right, to kill
yes,
this moose
of course,
for
the
educational.
Hunt. Yeah.
I mean, you know, hunting is highly, highly regulated.
Yeah.
And, you know, especially moose, you have to, you know, really, they require crazy traceability,
yes.
Which is fantastic. So he really talked about, you know, the learned anatomy, the biological
right.
piece.
That's right.
And he talked a lot about they will learn, you know, this is a traditional thing to do in Alaska.
Right.
So, you know, really focused on the traditions.
And the cultural
and,
piece there, yeah.
You know, I think the piece that you identified, which was also the one that came to mind to me, is just as important. And the teacher did admit in the piece, he said that when he first went in, there were a few students that he wasn't sure were going to be comfortable
right.
with this activity.
Mm-hmm.
He felt they were going to be squeamish. And I'm guessing that has to do with, you know, actually handling meat.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And something that shows up so obviously a dead body too, right? It's
yes.
one thing when it's like vac sealed in a cardboard case and that sort of thing, but when this clearly looks like something that once was alive and you are going to tear it apart and there's blood and muscle and all that stuff, that's a very different perspective.
And not to get too graphic, but I watched a video. They recorded the first bit of his class. And the very first thing he did was snap the feet off.
Or yes. Guess,
are they hooves? I guess.
Yes. Moose hooves. Sure.
And he, you know, he warned the class. This sound is going to be a little distressing. But it's interesting because it feels like that moment, there was like a shudder through the class. And
yes.
If anything, you know, to your earlier point, it really sort of grounded and focused everyone mm-hmm. to the task at hand. And the students were talking about, you know, how they weren't sure what it was going to be going into it. And
right.
they, you know, really found it rewarding. And the teacher was amazed at how, you know, focused they were. And
I was impressed, even just from the few photos that I saw. I didn't dig too deep further than that, but I was very intrigued by that, by how into it these high school students appeared to be.
Have you studied butchery?
A little bits. And in fact, when he was talking about that first crack of the leg, I remembered having to break down a half of a pig. Mm-hmm. We got a side of a pig in, I think it was when I was working at the stop. And I had to break this thing down into roasts, right? But I had two very furry hooves that I had to deal with, right? And there's that ball socket joint. And mm-hmm. there comes a point where the only thing to do is to just like the inside of a chicken thigh, right? Yeah. When you want to pull, you gotta, you know, you just gotta, you just gotta do it. But the fact that I was doing it on something that was recognizably hoofy and furry, and mm-hmm. you know what I mean? And still had some dirt on it from being in the ground. And that I was like the back of my cleaver and giving it. I remember thinking to myself, wow. And my coworkers were, you know, sort of walking through the kitchen, walking past, being like, oh, this is a different look for the kitchen. Okay. Okay. And I actually remember the rest of that, like 2 or 3 hours in the kitchen became much more solemn after I had snapped the two, you know, the calves essentially of this pig.
Yeah.
To have my way with it. It was quite intense. Definitely quite intense. I am curious. I mean, I guess if you work in a butcher shop, it's much more rote and everyday for you, but that was emotionally a mega thing for me. I needed like a moment to myself.
Yeah. I guess the reason I was asking is I'm highly aware, and I have been highly aware that butchering is it's a skill. It's a,
mm-hmm.
But there was a lot of talk of the, how well the students were following the bone. And it sounds like that's a critical piece, I guess. Is that about just making sure as much meat as possible is
it's the cleanest job, but also there's some wisdom to sort of let the skeleton of the animal guide you through the cuts are sort of anchored on the skeleton of the beast.
Cause a number of the students mentioned that and how they could really feel the bone and they were following it.
And that
was fascinating to me.
It's very blind work. It's lots of feel, you know, you do it by feel and not by visuals, because you want to get in and you want to get the tip of your knife to, you know, and then you give it a twist and then that'll pop out and this will separate this muscle from that muscle. But it's one hand and the other, right? And you're guiding yourself through. So their ability for the two hands to work together for the blade to follow the bone is a legitimate skill.
How cool.
All I hope is that they ate some of it afterwards.
They cooked a portion of it because a number of the students hadn't had moose meat before. And the rest was ground and sealed and given to families in the community that could use it.
So, amazing. Yeah. Amazing. This is a win-win-win story. I love it.
Speaking of meat, Joshna,
mm-hmm.
I came across this really interesting video from BBC Korea.
Okay.
And in South Korea, dogs are traditionally eaten in the summer months,
mm-hmm.
and mostly due to Western influence, more Koreans are, you know, they're starting to keep dogs as pets and they're starting to feel uncomfortable with the idea of dog meat.
Right.
And they've been pressuring the government to end this trade. And they've been quite effective. Two of the biggest dog meat markets in Korea have shut down in the past 3 years. And so this video brought together, I guess, for lack of a better term, pro dog meat eating people and anti dog meat eating people from Korea.
Yeah.
And brought them together to discuss. And I think the other interesting piece to note that came out in this video, which is something that needs to be considered in the overall conversation, is that the dog meat industry is not very strictly regulated in Korea.
Right.
And that sort of came up as an issue. But it's a really interesting video to watch. We'll have it in our show notes if anyone wants to see it. But I was wondering what your reactions were to it.
I thought it was I liked the way they positioned it. It was really interesting to see, right? There were clear opinions on both sides. People, right, talking about tradition and many elders, you know, who are still alive today for whom eating dog was just as regular as chicken and pig and cow.
And some younger folk as well who felt the same way.
I thought it was fascinating. The thing that was particularly interesting for me was that the impact of the Western, like the fact that there was in fact shame and a bit of internalization about an image connected to this Western influence. My first thought really would have been a pushback and then like, listen, you do what you want to do. We're going to do what we want to do.
They said it made them feel barbaric.
Right. They really felt,
I mean,
that.
That's a very carefully chosen word.
I agree. Right? I agree. I was very, very surprised at that. I didn't think that would land as intensely as it seems to have.
Yeah. What I thought was particularly cool is in the end, they came to an interesting middle ground, which was really live and let live. They were both very open to, if you don't want to do it, don't do it. And if you want to do it, do it. And focused and said their energy is, as I mentioned earlier, more on the fact that the industry does need to be better regulated. So as long as it's regulated and it's done well, then I found it interesting that this is the conclusion that they came to.
Also, like I have to say, there was this one dude who said that his distinction about this was about the kinds of affection that humans feel for dogs versus pigs. And I just don't think that that's a very solid thing to stand on, right? I think there's a lot of fluidity and human affection just in general. But the idea that we would eat a pig because nobody loves a pig the way somebody loves a dog, for me, that does not hold a lot of water, right? And I remember way back a few years ago, at least here in Toronto, there was an issue with horse meat being served at a French restaurant.
Yes, at La Palette.
And people lost their minds. Like, you know, equestrian folks, I think, were probably at the top of the list. Mm-hmm. People lost their minds about the idea that horse was being served anywhere. And they were blind, you know what I mean? Closed ears to the idea that there's actually a very long-standing culinary tradition around horse consumption. And I remember I got called for an interview about my opinion about this at the time. And the thing that I remember saying, the thing that came most instantly out of my mouth, was that the only difference here is that we don't cuddle up and brush, you know, pigs and cows and chickens. And if we did, we may have a different opinion about eating them, right? It's just because we have the intimacy that emotional connection to a horse that you don't have with a pig, a cow, or a chicken that makes it cool.
I agree with you 100%. That really struck me when he said that, because he said, you know, dogs are cute and cuddly when compared to pigs. And the whole notion that the cuter animals are worth saving while the less cute animals are okay to eat, based on this, what is essentially an aesthetic judgment.
Totally. And such a subjective notion of what is pleasing, right? Visually anyhow.
And I find it especially upsetting because guess who gets the short end of that stick? Fish.
Right.
Which is the animals that most need our protection.
That are most endangered.
Right now.
Exactly.
Yeah. So that was the other thing that was very interesting to me was the positioning of the segment.
Right.
Because they called it dogs as pets versus dogs for eating.
Yes.
As if they're mutually exclusive.
And then you can't do one. You have to do one or the other.
And you can't. You know, love an animal, but also
eat it.
Be okay with consuming it, which to me really promotes the notion of raising cattle as being, you know, cold and cruel. Whereas, as far as I know, a lot of people who raise animals really love their animals and treat them very well. So it just speaks to how detached we are to our food. And, you know, it's hard to acknowledge that, you know, when you're biting into a fried chicken sandwich, that, you know, an animal died to give you
that.
And it's almost like people want to detach the two. So they'd rather, I don't know. This is categorization.
Well, and there's a Netflix television show called Master of None. There's one episode on this where the father of one of the guys in the show talks about his life in China as a kid, and he had a pet chicken who he loved dearly, right? And one of the sort of rites of passage that his father put him through when he was like 8 or 9 years old, some young age, was that he had to kill this chicken for dinner.
Yeah.
Right. And the chicken was his friend. And as a 60 something year old man recoiling, you know what I mean? Recounting the story, you can see that the trauma is still with him, you know, from having been 8 or 9 years old and being forced to kill his beloved pet pal chicken.
That's intense.
Yeah. It's mega. Right.
I had a similar experience when I was 7, except I wasn't asked to kill it.
Right.
It was a rabbit that I was. Yeah. I was living on a farm at the time, and the rabbit was not well.
Okay.
So I had taken it under, put it in a little box, and I was taking care of it. And then, you know, one day it was no longer in the box, mm-hmm. and it was on the plate.
There it is. I think that we,
it's weird.
And the minute the comfort of our lives and the choices about our lives get confronted, that's when we start recreating measures and, you know, and gauges like that. It's like, oh, well, I don't, you know, I don't know anything that I'd cuddle up with when I was like, that's a completely subjective thing. And that part of the argument I find a bit irritating.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, at the end of the day, there's no reason to make people feel barbaric for traditional things that they.
It's lots of xenophobia, lots of othering, right? It's, there's no, in fact, oh my God, this is so interesting. I've just remembered watching an episode of Family Feud that was in South Africa, right? Mm-hmm. And stay with me on this tangent. The question was, what is the most favorite part of the chicken, the most popular part of the chicken for South Africans, right? And it was Steve Harvey, the American host, was doing a show, I'm guessing, in South Africa with South African families,
mm-hmm.
right? And the thing that was so fascinating was that the answers that all the family members were giving were like, chicken feet, chicken hearts, chicken gizzards, you know what I mean? All these sort the gnarlier bits.
Yeah.
And Steve Harvey was like, who are you people? What kind of place is this? How are you eating chicken? Like, and it was just, I was embarrassed for him, actually, at how narrowly he understood what was really going on, right?
Yeah.
And that you have to, in fact, grow an entire bird to do this. And that a lot of people around the world, it's not only just chicken thighs and drumsticks and breasts that people, you know, that people are into. It was a bit hard to watch, I have to say.
It also calls to mind that, which game is it, James Corden, who does that table of quote unquote disgusting foods, and it's like a truth or dare where you have to answer the question truthfully or eat this, again, quote unquote repellent food. And every time I watch it, I think, you know, some people eat this.
Exactly.
Some of them are a little kooky, they make them up, but a lot of them are just things that probably some people eat, and
like for dinner that night before watching the
show.
Exactly. We have to be much more careful, I think, about the way we talk about this and the messages that accompany those opinions. So Mirella, one of the things that I have been busy with in our pandemic times is helping a neighborhood organization that is really focused on getting good, healthy food to senior citizens, many of whom are living solo in apartment buildings and quite vulnerable as a result. And just, you know, thinking through the ripple impact of the pandemic has been an important one, particularly around food security. But there's a piece here about some beautiful folks in a similar kind of grassroots organization in New York who just wanted to take a moment to shine a light on the people that do go door to door to deliver these meals and that who have been supporting these largely seniors and other sorts of vulnerable folks. And I have to say, in the midst of everything that's happening in the world right now, I loved hearing a story about people just being really good and connected to each other, right? This, it warmed my heart. I really needed to hear it.
Yeah, and this is New York, where things got really bad
exactly
for a while there. And to hear that these people were, you know, unmoved and
making sure
that they were still delivering, you know, one of the things that really struck me was, you know, they were making sure that they stick to their schedule so that these people could have the food in time because they had to take it with their medication at a specific time.
Oh, just the awareness of that reality. Yeah.
And attention. And it also just made me stop and think because, you know, we've all been isolated and it's been stressful, I think, for everyone. But just to stop and think, being in that very vulnerable age range, potentially having underlying issues,
yeah,
it would be terrifying to leave the house.
Yeah.
And
you may just not even be able to, right? The body won't move, whatever it is. I mean, there was a photo in the piece of a pulley system that somebody had created, right? Where you see a package of food being yanked up by a big string to a, you know, second or third floor building. And just the idea that these super grassroots networks exist this way, right? So many of the reports in the story were that they know the sound of their knock or the footsteps outside the door, and all that's so sweet. And when I drop off soup and baked goods that I pick up from my chef pals around the city, and Building Roots TO is the name of this nice organization here in Moss Park. And one of the things
that's your Friday run, right?
That's my Friday run, exactly. Yeah. And I just finished week 16. Right? It kind of blows me away that the first time I did it was with these dead quiet streets with a winter jacket on. And just this last week I traded in oatmeal muffins for a little basket of strawberries that I left on someone's porch.
Oh, lovely.
But the thing that really struck me, and every Friday when I see these nice people packing these bags for these folks, is that grassroots networks of people who care about each other is the only way that our future, you know, that's what our future has to be, right? It's the fact that we are in this together and I care about how you are, you care about how I am, and that's how we're actually going to, you know, move forward and be healthy and have a thriving community. It's super inspiring. Fridays are easily my favorite day of the week as a result.
Yeah, and on that note, I also love that this shone a light, and it really supports seniors who want to remain independent, right? Because these are people, of course, the worst, the people who are always need their food delivered, but this is a whole new subsection of people who under normal conditions would just go to their local senior center for their meals, and, you know, who want to remain independent and are probably normally fine.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that this supports them in their choice. On a completely different note, Jashna.
Yes.
I came across this very interesting, I think I can go ahead and call it a gadget that has been developed.
I think so.
It's called We Scream.
Mm-hmm.
And what it is they're marketing it as a musical ice cream cone. And it is in the shape of an ice cream cone, but it's, you know, it's plastic. It's got wires in it.
Right.
And then you put your actual cone and your ice cream in it, as far as I can see. And as you eat, it makes sounds. And from what I understand, as if there's someone else who has one nearby, you can interact with other cones. And this is being marketed as, I quote, a digital upgrade that stimulates happiness and playfulness and provides a social eating experience.
Right.
It is pretty kooky.
It's totally kooky. But to your point, I love the first line that really struck me was a playful social gastrosonic experience.
Mm-hmm.
Gastrosonic was new for me. I get it, but it was wild. So there actually is a video of people eating these ice cream cones, right? So they have like a regular ice cream cone and then that's sitting in this juiced up gadget. And so somebody takes a bite of ice cream and the music notes ensue. And then they sort of volley it over to their pal, right? And the architects of all of this are interviewed and they talk about how it's this like incredible new way for people to interact with each other when they're eating ice cream. Mm-hmm. And what I think is so great is that they address it as though this is a thing that people have been asking for.
Yeah.
As though, like, finally, I can now, right? It was super cute.
I can make sounds while I eat. It's what I've always wanted to do.
I can really connect with my ice cream eating partner, which I have to say, one of the things that I really noticed was that I felt pressure to consume ice cream at a certain rate to be able to, to play along with somebody else.
Oh, you think?
Yeah. Well, I was like, I sort of pushed myself on this thinking, mm-hmm. and it came to the idea that eating ice cream is actually something that I savor.
Yes.
Right. For me, it's a moment, just me and the ice cream. I spend time thinking about how it melts away on my tongue and crunching the little bits and whatever it is. So the idea of me eating something and then waiting for somebody else's response, these people were literally chomping through the ice cream cone.
That's true.
Right. And I was like,
but they were reporting that they were enjoying it more. Interesting.
They were. And in my mind, I was like, maybe these people just don't know how to eat ice cream.
maybe we just don't.
Yeah.
I had a few thoughts. Well, first of all, they did, like you said, they made it sound like this is going to catch like on like wildfire. And they're also talking about maybe cocktail applications, like in cocktail bars. Maybe I imagine it would be the glass that would make music as you're drinking. But Imagine being in an establishment where everyone has one of these.
Yeah.
What a cacophony. That's like, that one person on the subway who's, watching a YouTube video without headphones or whatever. It's just like too much noise everywhere. That's a bit of a barrier.
Yeah.
And although I would definitely love to play, something that I think would be fun at home to play with, there is a little piece of me that can't help but start thinking, like, why do we need a gadget to be able to just put down our phone and enjoy our food and interact with the person in front of us?
Yeah, I don't.
You know what I mean?
I'm not sure. I mean, sure we can, and they 3D printed that cone, and that I'm sure that's exciting. But I don't know, like, is this a thing that anybody was asking for?
Yeah. Also, how long would it be exciting for? I feel like if I did it once or twice,
that would be enough.
Right?
You wouldn't be like, hey there, meet you down in the kitchen. let's make some music with our ice cream. Like, I don't know. Maybe I need to open my heart to it, but I'm not sure, man. I'm not sure. And I think that there's a disconnect here with the way people enjoy ice cream. I think ice cream is a more savored thing. I don't think we chomp down ice cream.
Right.
Right. I think we take a slower time with it, and to consider it, because honestly, when you have good ice cream, the feeling of that dairy fat melting away on is not, there's nothing quite like that, right? I like to spend time just with that, and I'm not interested in making any noises. Or even if it's music, right? Even if it's music, it's not for me.
If you're enjoying our podcast, please support us at patreon.com/hotplatepod. Hot Plate is part of the Frequency Podcast Network. Please consider leaving us a rating or review. It helps others find us. You can follow us on Instagram and Twitter at HotPlatePod. Follow me at Beerology on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. And follow Joshna at Joshna Maharaj on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. Original music by Dave Bell. Hot Plate is produced by Mirella Amato, that's me, and Dennis Coyne. Thanks for listening.